So I was there at Amaravati when this exchange took place. That's why I put it at the front of the article. And Ajahn Sumedho made this statement with great vigor, a lot of strength. That kind of question is asked by someone who understands nothing about Buddhism. So it was had a big impact on the audience. So our friend Marco is asking me how I would respond. So he told me earlier today he was going to ask this. So I was reflecting. And one of the skills that someone who's in the role of teaching in Buddhism needs to develop is the appropriate way of responding to questions. So if to the question, which is the best path, the path of the arahant or the path of the bodhisattva, my response would be, what do you mean by arahant? What do you mean by bodhisattva? And what do you mean by the best? Later on this evening, in my presentation, I'll offer some thoughts on what Ajahn Sumedho meant when he made that statement, and also why I responded in that way. So you can leave that till later. That can be for the dessert. So this subject, the arahat path and the bodhisattva path and the comparisons between them, this is a very common theme, particularly in the West, because there's a very frequent mingling, meeting of different Buddhist traditions. So outside of Tibet and Japan and Thailand and China and Sri Lanka, Burma, India, Nepal, then we are now meeting different Buddhist traditions. Often in one country, you don't commonly have a mixture of northern and southern Buddhism. Maybe just in Nepal and in Vietnam, you get both traditions represented in one country. But most countries just have either the northern Mahayana, Vajrayana style, or the southern Theravada style. But now in the West, there's a lot of meeting, a lot of crossover, and many, many Western students of Buddhism, Buddhist practice, are reading books or meeting teachers or going to events that represent both of these traditions. And because they have quite differently stated goals, the goal of the arahat or the goal of the bodhisattva practice, then people wonder, how does this work? How does this all fit together? So my purpose in writing that article, which is included in this book, got printed last year, that was originally in The Lion's Roar. The reason why I wrote that was because people keep asking these questions. I thought, well, if I just write it, then I can just give them a copy. So I don't have to keep, it's laziness really. So I don't keep having to say the same things over and over again. But I'm very happy to be here at Tibet House to say some of these things and to discuss with my new friend, Venerable Tenzin Peljo. Also, the purpose of this evening is not to have an argument or a debate to decide, you know, who's best, like a kind of dharmic arm wrestling, the A team or the B team, arahat team or bodhisattva team. The browns or the reds, but rather to explore this whole area of understanding, and also particularly to look at what are the presumptions that we make about the practice that we have, the words that we use, and the ideas that we've come to be familiar with. To begin by briefly stating what these two paths are, present it as being something as sort of definitively true, and all of the story, but just my understanding of things. So I would say the path of the arahat, which is described in the Buddhist scriptures of the southern Buddhist world, also in many of the northern Buddhist world, particularly in the ancient scriptures, the Agama in China and other places. The path of the Arahant is to work very directly on your own mind, your own life, in order to train the mind to completely let go, completely free itself from greed, hatred, and delusion. And that is the principal work of a spiritual practice, as encouraged in the Southern Buddhist scriptures, the Pali scriptures. And so then for the Northern Buddhist teaching, I will not presume to be an authority, but I will quote Shantideva. So this is from the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. So it's Shantideva writing about this very principle. And very good. My trusty translator's got his own copy, so page 358. With a wish to free all beings, I shall always go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, until I reach full enlightenment, filled with wisdom and compassion. Today, in the Buddha's presence, I generate the mind for full awakening, for the benefit of all sentient beings. As long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain and dispel the miseries of the world. So these are brief descriptions of these two paths. And I think listening to those words, they are both very admirable. They are, in a sense, both very inspiring to people in different ways. And I feel it's also important, and this was a point that was made by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi in his extremely good essay called Arahats, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, that you can find online by Bhikkhu Bodhi, that we're all disciples of the Buddha, whichever pathway we are following, that we all take the Buddha as our guide, and we're all following the example of the Buddha and look to him as a spiritual mentor. There are a number of different aspects to the paths, and also I think it's important to recognize that even though each path might explain itself in very clear ways, that you say, okay, this is the path, this is how you should follow it, whether it's the path of the Bodhisattva or the path towards Arahantship, then if you look a bit closely at the scriptures, there are some problems, there are some questions. And it was really interesting to see in that essay of Bhikkhu Bodhi's that he spotted some of the same questions that I did, and that are interesting and strange, what you call anomalies, things that don't quite make sense in both traditions, both in the northern tradition and the southern tradition. If you look a little closely at the paths, they're not quite so straightforward. There's things that are strange or mysterious about them. So that even though they might be presented in a very, this is the way, kind of absolutely clear, a little closer examination shows us like, there's more to this picture than I thought before. So in terms of the Pali scriptures, one of the strange aspects of this is there's no place in the Pali canon where anybody asks the Buddha, how can I become a Buddha? No one asks him, how did you undertake the path of the Bodhisattva? What was the way that you trained yourself? Who were your teachers? Nobody asks, ever. There's not a word about it. The Buddha doesn't ever get asked, is it better to follow the path of the Arahat or the Bodhisattva? There's not a word on that in the whole of the Pali canon. So this is what I would call a mysterious silence, or a significant silence. And Bhikkhu Bodhi noticed the same thing. That because if you are the disciple, a student of a particular teacher, you like to emulate your teacher. You like to follow their way. You want to do what they did. You want to be like them. That's how we are as students. So it's very strange that there is nobody who even asks, would it be a good idea for me to make the vow to become a Buddha in the future? Is that a good idea? What would you say, Venerable Sir? No one asks him. And so that it's not the case that if people ask stupid questions or questions that are say not useful, that that they are excluded from the Pali canon. There are many exchanges of the Buddha with people who ask questions that are foolish or come from a deluded view, or that are the Buddha says that's not worth asking, and many exchanges like that. But this issue of the taking on the life of training to become a Buddha in the future, nobody asks. There's no word. So this is a very loud silence. So on the other side, on the northern side, the most obvious anomaly or strangeness there, and you have this within the tradition in China, Japan, I believe in Tibet, as well as you have in the Southern School, is that immediately after the Buddha's enlightenment, his first inclination was not to teach. That he's reached full enlightenment under the Bodhi tree in Bodhgaya, and his first during that first period, he realizes what I've awakened to. This is too subtle. This is too deep. This goes so much against the stream of human understanding, a human habit and opinion. There's no point in me teaching. So I'll just remain quiet and be a hermit. And so then the Brahma deity arrives in front of the Buddha and says, please, for the sake of those with a little dust in their eyes, please teach what you understand for the benefit of all beings. And then the Buddha spent the next 45 years teaching. So the mystery is, if the Buddha had spent, as it says in the scriptures, 4 asaṅkhya kalpas and 100,000 other ordinary kalpas ago, he'd been in training since the time of making the vow with the Buddha Dipankara, incredible amount of time to develop the paramitas, to reach Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. Finally, after 4 incalculable periods and 100,000 eons, finally he arrives at full and complete enlightenment, and then he decides, it's not worth me teaching. No one's going to understand this, so I'll just go and be quiet. That's again a very mysterious thing. And it's there in all of our scriptures. Even though the Bodhisattva ideal is for the benefit of all beings, the example that we have from the Buddha is, at his enlightenment, the first thought is, there's no point trying. So that's another an anomaly or a strangeness that is interesting and perhaps useful to investigate. The last of the mysteries I will share with you is that you have very different maps for the relationship between the Arahat and the Bodhisattva in different Buddhist traditions, so across the Buddhist world. I haven't studied this in detail, but over the years, so I've been in the monastery for quite a number of years, so I've studied a number of different Buddhist scriptures, and you have at least 3 different models of the relationship between the Arahat and the Bodhisattva. So in the usual system for Bodhisattvas, they talk about the 10 Bodhisattva bhumis, or 10 grades, 10 grounds, or 10 stages of training for a Bodhisattva. Correct?
Yes, Bodhisattva from the path of seeing onwards.
So these are the 10 Bodhisattva bhumis. So in some recensions, some expressions of the teaching, you have to be an arahant before you can get onto bhumi number 1. You have to have already got your master's degree before you can join the PhD program. So that there's no way you can get onto the Bodhisattva bhumis until you're already an arahant. Another set of teachings say that the arahantship is realized at the 7th Bodhisattva bhumi. And then the last 3, 8, 9, and 10, are sort of post-arahant stage. And then the third model is what you have in the Theravada, which is the Buddha realized arahantship and Buddhahood at the same time. So the 10th Bodhisattva Bhumi is completed and Buddhahood is realized at the same time as arahantship. So you don't become an arahat until you become a Buddha. The Buddhahood and arahantship are realized at the same time. So who's right? So this is another one of those mysteries that that is there in the pot, and so I wanted just to share that with you, not to create more confusion or more doubt, but just to, in a sense, look closely at the field and the different perspectives, the different ways that this territory has been mapped in the past. Then going back to the reflection that these are both very noble aspirations for a human being. They're very noble and wonderful, beautiful spiritual goals for us as human beings. Why is it that over the years there has been a conflict or competition or a kind of, negative, afflictive feelings that have grown up over time in some places between these two groups? And I would say this is an issue of what in English you would call tribalism, if that's not too derogatory to people living in tribes, where it's to say that we're from Frankfurt and we're much better than those people from Hamburg. Or the people from the Berlin people, we're much better because we're from Frankfurt. So it's a competition between towns or families or football teams or whatever it might be. We have a tribe. We're the brown team, maroon, red team, you know. But this is my team. We're good. We're this side of the river. Those people on the other side of the river, no good. And this instinct goes back to our ancient origins, hundreds of thousands of years ago, probably millions of years ago, to our kind of hunter-gatherer lives, and even before. If you look at the lives of baboons or chimpanzees or gorillas, that are the kind of related families, they function in the same way, that this is our territory, this is our group, and the other group comes close to the border, back off, go away. Kind of snarl at each other, and you feel a sense of affiliation, belonging to your group, and the other group, they're the enemy, they're the problem, they're the raiders, they come and steal your fruit off your trees. So these are ancient instincts, and the tragedy is that we get this kind of tribal attachment, this clinging to our group, the A-team, B-team, Arahant team, Bodhisattva team, and even though the content of what we are attaching to is very beautiful and noble and liberating, the act of attaching turns it into its opposite. And so as our teacher Ajahn Chah would say that even if what you have faith in, what you believe in, is very virtuous, the way you pick it up can make it an obstacle to spiritual growth. So he used the expression, you can be right in fact, but wrong in Dharma. So in the scriptures, the worst examples of this that I'm aware of is this kind of what is called mythic defamation. Defamation. So to defame, to using the mythology, the stories to defame or to make people look bad. So the worst examples you find are in the Vimalakirti Sutra and the Lotus Sutra, where the arahats are made to look like idiots. Like Sariputta is made to look like a fool. He's in comedy, what they call the fall guy, the one who is made fun of. And so Vimalakirti is kind of making fun of Sariputta for being this kind of narrow-minded arahant. And in the Lotus Sutra, you have the arahants kind of weeping. Oh, it's such a shame, I've realized Nibbana already. Oh, what have I done? What a terrible mistake. And then the Buddha says, don't worry, it's all right. You know, you just thought you'd realize Nibbana and that's the end of your path. But actually, that was just an illusion. That was like the magic city that appeared to give you refreshment. It wasn't really the end of the path. Don't worry, you can still join the Bodhisattva path. Oh, hooray, hooray, hooray. I haven't wasted my life by becoming an arahant. So, with all due respect to the Lotus Sutra and the Vimalakirti Sutra, which possess a lot of beautiful wisdom, I would call this instances of mythic defamation. But it's also not to malign the northern Buddhist people, because the Buddha does the same thing in the Pali scriptures to the Brahmins. So the Brahmins get the same kind of defamation by the Buddha. He's always making fun of the Brahmins. They're always being shown up to be proud and kind of inflated, kind of conceited. So there are many, many instances of this where the Buddha is sort of making fun of the Brahmins. And the worst instance I know of this in the Pali Canon is where there's a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, Book of the Fives, where the sutta is called the five characteristics of Brahmins that are not possessed by dogs. And the Buddha lines up what dogs do and what Brahmins do, and how what Brahmins do is worse than what dogs do. So, and a dog, as most of you know, in Asian society, a dog does not have a very high status, not like here in the West. So it's the Buddha saying these the behavior of the Brahmins is worse than the dogs in these five instances. So that in exactly the same way, it's a kind of shock tactic that is quite deliberately insulting. And so I would say this is a something that is not helpful in enabling us to understand these paths of the Arhant and the path of the Bodhisattva. But rather, if we buy into those statements or we take them at face value, then we miss the more profound or complete picture. So when these positions are attached to, then Bhikkhu Bodhi came up with these two very useful terms. Said that when these both the Arahat ideal and the Bodhisattva ideal are clung to and identified with, this leads to Mahayana elitism and Nikaya, or Pali Nikaya, purism. So these are how he characterizes the way the mind clings to these attitudes at the adherents to the Pali Canon say we're pure, we're the original, we're the best, and those Mahayanists are all heretical eternalists. And then the Mahayanists say that we've got the pure way, the vast way, the superior way, and those Theravadins, they're a bunch of life denying nihilists, the narrow minded nihilists. So essentially the problem is that of clinging, attachment to views and opinions. And there's a very helpful teaching that I'll quote from the Pali Canon, where the Buddha talks about how the mind has these tendencies either towards the nihilism, like wanting things to end or looking forward to things ending, or the mind wanting things to go on forever. So that this is a passage from the Itiwuttaka, and this is the Buddha's words. This is Itiwuttaka Sutta number 49.
The page?
It's on page 357. Okay. Bhikkhus, held by two kinds of views, some devas and human beings hold back and some overreach. Only those with vision see. And how, bhikkhus, do some hold back? Some devas and humans enjoy being, delight in being, are satisfied with being. When the Dhamma is taught to them for the cessation of being, their minds do not enter into it or acquire confidence in it or settle upon it or become resolved upon it. Thus, bhikkhus, do some hold back. And how, bhikkhus, do some overreach? Now some are troubled, ashamed, and disgusted by this very same quality of being, and they rejoice in the idea of non-being, asserting, "Good sirs, when this body perishes at death, this self is annihilated and destroyed and does not exist any more. This is true peace. This is excellent. This is reality." Thus, bhikkhus do some overreach. That's a very popular view amongst Western Buddhists, at least on the Theravada side. And then the last paragraph. How, bhikkhus, do those with vision see? Herein, one sees what has come to be as having come to be. Having seen it thus, one practices the course for turning away, for dispassion, for the cessation of what has come to be. Thus, bhikkhus, do those with vision see. So in essence, that is saying when there's the deluded view of identification, it either goes to me looking forward to everything ending, or me wanting to be here forever. And the Buddha points us as the two extreme views, and the middle way is rather to be that awakened awareness that watches everything arising and passing away, that is not identified with that process at all. So that teaching of the Buddha and the instruction to embody the quality of wisdom or awareness, this is the essence of his teaching on the Four Noble Truths. And you can, when reflecting on the path of the Arahant and the path of the Bodhisattva, both from the early scriptures as represented in the Pali and then in the later scriptures of the Northern School, the Mahayana, Vajrayana scriptures, that I would say, and this can come up for discussion, I'm eager to hear what Venerable Tenzin Palgyo would say, I would say that the Bodhisattva path is a skillful means, just as the Arahant path is a skillful means based directly on that same insight into the Four Noble Truths, and that when we look at that closely, and I'll speak in a moment about different aspects of the Four Noble Truths in relationship to the Mahayana, the Bodhisattva path, then it can see a great compatibility between the Arahant path and the Bodhisattva path, as they both stem from this core insight that arises from the investigation and realization of the Four Truths. In the time that I've been a monk, I've stayed many times in Tibetan monasteries, in Zen temples, in Chinese monasteries, and joined in many pujas. And it's very, very common that during the pujas that are carried out, there's both the recitation of the four Bodhisattva vows, and there's also the recitation of the Heart Sutra. So in the four Bodhisattva vows, I'm not sure what your version is, but as I've remembered them, living beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. Afflictions are limitless, I vow to cut them all off. The Buddha way is unsurpassed, I vow to accomplish it. The Dharma doors are endless, I vow to enter them. Dharma doors are limitless, I vow to enter them all. Now, these are the four Bodhisattva vows, as they are chanted every day in these northern Buddhist monasteries, temples, as I've experienced. And it's interesting that the four vows are directly based on the Four Noble Truths. And again, in this little essay, that I quote that from a commentary by a Chinese master on the Brahmajala Sutra, the Brahmanet Sutra. And the way one can view this is that it's taking the Four Noble Truths, and so in the 400 years after the Buddha's time, by that time the focus of the monastic community was very much on personal liberation, and maybe it had got a bit too narrow, and so that then there was this statement of the Bodhisattva vows as expressing that the Four Noble Truths don't just apply to us as individuals, they apply to all beings. So, living beings are numberless relates to there is suffering, which is the First Noble Truth. Living beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. All beings are suffering. Afflictions are limitless, I vow to cut them all off. That is related to the Second Noble Truth. Craving is the cause of suffering. The Buddha way is supreme, I vow to accomplish it. That is related to the third truth, that which is the dukkha nirodha, the cessation of suffering, is the ending of dukkha. And then the fourth truth, that Dharma doors are limitless, I vow to enter them all, is related to the Eightfold Path. So it takes the four truths and deliberately spells them out as functioning in relationship to all beings, not just related to this being. So it's taking the four truths and saying, look, look, you open the lid and say, look, within these, it's not just an individual, it's all beings. And then the Heart Sutra, in the Heart Sutra, you have the words of, it's saying, there is no suffering, there is no origination, there is no cessation, there is no path, there's no understanding and no attaining, for there is nothing to attain. So right there, often chanted in the same puja, you have the four truths expanded to relate to all beings, but also recognized as being empty of substance. There is really no suffering. And these two are side by side. So both recognizing the four truths are not absolute truths, they're relative truths that if they're understood, they can help to liberate us. Suffering is not absolute. So the emptiness quality is reflected in the Heart Sutra, and the altruistic quality is reflected in the four bodhisattva vows. But they both originate from the Four Noble Truths as their root and their origin. So it's a way of opening up the four truths to say, look, they're empty. There is no thing actually there. There's no essence, but they are these skillful means. And then the bodhisattva vows are saying, look, these apply to everyone. Look at that. So I'm aware I just have a few more minutes for my presentation. And so I'll just complete what I'm saying with the key point is that the troublemaker is self-view. That whether, just as with that teaching from the Itivuttaka, I want to stay behind, I want it all to be over, I want it to go forever. The I am is the troublemaker, the difficulty. And so that when we recognize this, then and see the emptiness of the self idea, and see that is insubstantial, then the questions arise, well, who is going to stay and save all beings? Who is going to stay behind? You know, who is going to end the rebirth and not be born again? Is there a person who was really born and who is not going to be born again? Is that what's happening? Or is it not? So that when that quality of wisdom, awakened wisdom, is aroused, then it changes the perspective on what is a living being. And I'll read a final couple of passages to share this with you. But before that, I was going back to Ajahn Sumedho's statement at the beginning, saying, which is the best path, the path of the Bodhisattva or the path of the Arahant? I feel that what Ajahn Sumedho was saying, like someone who asked that doesn't understand anything about Buddhism, is like, you're thinking of Arahant or Bodhisattva as people, as a person. You're kind of locking those principles into your own habits of self-view. And also at the beginning of the essay, actually before the Ajahn Sumedho statement, there's a statement by Ajahn Chah, our teacher, who said, don't be an arahant, don't be a bodhisattva, don't be anything at all. If you're anything at all, you'll suffer. So the principle I feel is in the use of these skillful means is there identification? Is there self-view being built around the practice of the Arahant path or the practice of the Bodhisattva path? If there's a me who's practicing the path, then it's going to lead to suffering. if the path is free of self-view, then it will lead to benefit. So I'll just finish with these two quotations from the book here. This is page 360 and 361. Page 362, first of all, the Vajra Sutra. So this is from the Diamond Sutra, again a Northern Buddhist teaching. The Buddha said, Subhuti, they are neither living beings nor no living beings. And why? Subhuti, living beings are spoken of by the Tathagata as no living beings. Therefore they are called living beings. Subhuti, what do you think? You should not maintain that the Tathagata has this thought, I shall take living beings across. Subhuti, do not have that thought. And why? There are actually no living beings taken across by the Tathagata. If there were living beings taken across by the Tathagata, then the Tathagata would have the existence of a self, of others, of living beings, and of a life. Subhuti, the existence of a self spoken of by the Tathagata is no existence of a self, but common people take it as the existence of a self. Subhuti, common people are spoken of by the Tathagata as no common people. Therefore, they are called common people. And the next the next passage from another tradition altogether is from Sri Ramana Maharshi. People often say that a liberated master should go out and preach his message to the people. How can anyone be a master, they argue, as long as there is misery by his side? This is true. But who is a liberated master? Does he see misery beside him? They want to determine the state of a master without realizing the state themselves. From the standpoint of the master, their contention amounts to this. A man dreams a dream in which he finds several people. On waking up, he asks, "Have the dream people also woken up?" How ridiculous! In the same way, a good man says, "It doesn't matter if I never get liberation, or let me be the last man to get it, so that I may help all others to be liberated before I am." Wonderful! Imagine a dreamer saying, "May all these dream people wake up before I do." The dreamer is no more absurd than this amiable philosopher. So, thank you very much indeed. So, I think I've said enough to begin things this evening, and I pass it over to my friend, Venerable Tenzin Peljol.